This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, tensions are rising in France about the deaths of black men in police custody. California's medical marijuana industry is grappling with the prospect of full legalization. And the Summer Olympics begin in Rio. We'll talk to residents of the Brazilian city's favelas who were forcibly evicted ahead of the Games. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Two more incidents of black people killed by police are galvanizing the movement for accountability in law enforcement this week. In Chicago, the Independent Police Review Authority released video Friday of the events that led to the shooting death of an unarmed black youth late last week. Multiple officers opened fire as Paul O'Neill crashed a stolen vehicle. Despite body-worn and dash cam video recorded during the incident, the fatal shot was not captured, but the 18-year-old ran from the car and was shot in the back as he tried to flee. The video was made public just days after Baltimore police killed a young black mother, Corinne Gaines, while she was holed up in her apartment with her 5-year-old son. An officer shot Gaines after an hours-long armed standoff, during which she posted to Facebook. Saying they needed to control negotiations, law enforcement asked Facebook moderators to suspend her account, and the social media platform complied. Police admit they fired first, striking the woman who then returned fire. The child was also hurt, but is expected to recover. Family members want to know why the standoff ended in police use of lethal force. Shannon Gaines, Corinne's aunt, told WBAL-TV that her niece was not an active threat.
Why would they kill her over standing her ground in her own home? She wasn't shooting at them. She wasn't openly firing on the police officers. She was sitting in the floor of her apartment.
Both cases add to a string of police killings caught on video in recent months. The rapid spread of information on social media has sparked widespread calls for police accountability and even abolition. Earlier this week, protesters calling for changes in law enforcement leadership encamped in Los Angeles and Chicago were joined in New York City, with calls for the mayor to fire embattled New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton. Just one day later, Bratton announced his pending resignation, though both he and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio insisted the timing was coincidental.
110% has nothing to do with this.
Bratton is an architect of so-called broken windows law enforcement, in which police aggressively pursue disorderly conduct on the theory that there is a trickle-up effect on major crimes. Critics say the model, now used in cities across the country, is inherently biased and exacerbates tension between officers and the communities they're sworn to serve. Joel Northam is one of the organizers of a New York coalition of police abolitionists who are occupying a park across from City Hall.
It's a racist mechanism of social control. They know it, we know it. It's basically, Frederick Douglass said it back in 1845 when he said, they whipped the slaves for the slightest offenses to discourage them from committing larger ones. This is exactly what we're seeing the police do with broken windows.
Two police officers were convicted this week on charges related to the shootings of unarmed citizens. In Baltimore, an officer was found guilty of assault in the non-fatal shooting of a 46-year-old burglary suspect. And in Portsmouth, Virginia, another officer was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in the shooting of a black teen accused of shoplifting. In the UK, roads leading to major airports, including London's Heathrow, were shut down by British Black Lives Matter protests Friday. The actions marked 5 years since police shot and killed a 29-year-old black man, Mark Duggan, sparking riots in North London. And in France, recent protests in the Parisian suburbs followed last month's death of a 24-year-old black man who was apparently suffocated in the back of a police van. FSRN's Khaled Sidmohan reports from Paris.
31-year-old Assa Traoré is grieving. Last month, her brother Adama Traoré died on his 24th birthday in police custody here in the Parisian suburb where he lived. The young man from the suburb of Beaumont-sur-Oise had been arrested after confronting police over their arrest of his brother. The brother was released without charge, but his older brother was never again seen alive. Adama was a French citizen born in France, but his sister says the family decided to send his body to their father's village in Mali.
Certains voulaient qu'il reste ici, mais finalement on s'est dit qu'il serait mieux auprès de son père. Il a été
If he was buried in France, it would have been easier for us to visit him in a nearby cemetery. But after a certain amount of soul searching, we decided that as he was killed on French soil by French police, burying him in France would be like a gift to this country. So he won't be buried here.
On va pas l'enterrer ici.
The circumstances of the July 19th death still aren't clear. The first autopsy declared he has succumbed to a serious infection, but the local prosecutor wrote that it had been heart failure. These contradictory accounts have angered the family and fueled suspicions of a clumsy cover-up. The police report states that the three policemen had trundled him into a van and were sitting on him to restrain him. And there are conflicting reports by the police officers and prosecution over whether he resisted arrest. The family's lawyer says the 24-year-old could have suffocated under the weight of three grown men and says there's evidence that first death certificate was doctored. The family commissioned a second autopsy which revealed he'd indeed asphyxiated from a lack of oxygen. There are parallels between Adama Traoré's death and that of Freddie Gray, who died in the back of a police van in Baltimore last year. Pierre Motin is with ACAT, a French rights group that campaigns against the death penalty and police violence in general.
In the French suburbs, where the police brutalities seem to be very more frequent, people don't press charges, or when they try to press charges, these charges are not recorded.
There are also common themes here, as with the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States.
We noticed that almost all the victims of police brutalities in France are young men from visible minorities, black people, North African, they are the main targets of police brutalities in France.
Family members, friends and other sympathizers tried to hold a peaceful rally against police brutality last weekend, but authorities denied them a permit to march. France has been under a state of emergency since last November's deadly attacks, and police have expanded powers to arbitrarily forbid public demonstrations.
What we know is that the Muslim community in France has been especially targeted by these measures.
That's Nicolas Crameillard of Amnesty International's French chapter. He says counter-terrorism police have raided about 3,500 houses in these suburbs, all without warrants and all without producing enough evidence for an indictment on terror-related charges.
Our report on what has been done during the first 3 months of the state of emergency in France show clear discriminatory and arbitrary measures taken against the Muslim community. And 9 months of state of emergency in France, there has been no judicial inquiry against them.
Rights activists say statistics show that on average 15 people are killed by the law enforcement every year.
We've lived here in the suburbs, which are now under a state of emergency, for more than 30 years. The police now are well trained, and the military weapons they're currently using have been tested in our neighborhoods.
That's Amel Bentounsi, a 40-year-old activist. She founded an anti-police brutality organization after her 28-year-old brother was fatally shot in the back by police in 2012. Her brother's killing was ruled justified out of self-defense. The second autopsy for Adama Traoré won't be certified until later this month. Tensions remain high in the Parisian suburbs, where unemployment and distrust of the police remain higher than the rest of the country. And there are fears that without real answers, widespread unrest could be on the horizon. Khaled Sidmohand, FSRN, Paris.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. The Olympic Games officially begin in Rio de Janeiro, and hundreds of thousands of tourists, athletes, and officials are expected to descend on the city. Protesters held an anti-Olympics opening ceremony Thursday, decrying state violence and forced evictions in the run-up to the Games. FSRN's Sam Cowie reports.
As the Olympic Games begin, political uncertainty persists in the country. But for many residents of Rio de Janeiro, concerns are more basic because they've been forced to move from the places they called home. Sonia Braga was told she had to abandon her home, which was then destroyed to make way for a rapid bus transit line, considered one of the main legacies of the Games. She was relocated more than an hour away from her former home, miles along a rutted road and far from the city infrastructure. The new place is an isolated area where organized crime is prevalent. Sonia, who suffers from high blood pressure, complains of long commutes now to visit her doctor.
It's difficult for ambulances to get here. You have to go down to the main street to be picked up. By the time you've gone there, you'll die.
Between 2009, when Brazil won the right to host the Olympics, and 2015, more than 22,000 Rio families were forced to relocate and resettle elsewhere in the city. The number of evictions directly or indirectly linked to the Olympics remains contested, with City Hall claiming that just one favela, or shantytown, was removed to make way for the Olympic Park. But human rights groups say that many more families were uprooted for projects that were either directly or indirectly linked to the Olympics, that more like 2,500 families were forced out. Simone de Conceição lived in an abandoned factory in the centre of Rio, of around 24 families with nowhere else to live. The building was raised as part of another so-called Olympic Legacy project. De Conceição was relocated to a public housing block more than an hour from the city centre.
We have a good relationship with our neighbours, who we know from the city centre. But apart from that, there are no good things here. The school is really bad and there is no work.
The housing situation, however, is not entirely black and white. Some families, arguably, have benefited from being placed in newly built public housing blocks. Orlando Santos Jr., a professor at the Urban and Regional Planning Research Institute at Rio State University, says that the first removals were brutal.
Even if people were living in better houses, does this justify the violence of the state to take people from their community? Does this justify a segregated model of urbanization where rich are separated from poor? Does it justify preventing people from deciding where to live?
The Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro will last just more than 2 weeks and will be followed by the Paralympic Games. For those removed from their homes, however, the legacy will be bitter and last a lifetime. Sam Cowie, FSRN, Rio de Janeiro.
In India, attacks against members of the Dalit caste at the hands of Hindu extremists are on the rise. But as FSRN's Bismila Gilani reports, Dalits are increasingly standing up for their rights.
A peaceful sit-in protest by hundreds of Dalit students and teachers last Saturday was held in downtown New Delhi to protest recent attacks against their caste community. Without warning, men appear swinging iron rods and batons to break up the sit-in. These men are not riot police, they are Hindu nationalists. The police are here too, dozens of them, but they just watch this one-sided fight as the Dalits are beaten. Ratanlal is a 40-year-old instructor at Delhi University and member of the Dalit caste. He says, if Dalits can be assaulted in broad daylight in India's capital, think how bad it is in villages.
Attacks like this show their increasing frustration over the resistance the Dalits are now putting up. They want to keep us enslaved like they did for centuries. But this is the 21st century, and it belongs to us. We are no longer going to accept this bondage.
Indeed, last weekend's protest in New Delhi is part of a larger campaign by the Dalit community to resist increasing attacks and marginalization within Indian society. Once known as untouchables, for centuries Dalits were considered to be the lowest rung in the complex Hindu caste system. But increasingly, Dalits are no longer willing to wear that label, and an attack against one is seen as an attack on all. Last month, members of a Hindu nationalist group called Gau Raksha Samiti, or Cow Protection Committee in English, posted video taken in Gujarat of a group of Dalit youth they had captured, beaten, and then dragged behind a car as they hurled abuse. Their crime? Skinning a dead cow with the intent to sell the hide. The video went viral, with both Hindus and Dalits enraged by what they saw, but for different reasons. Local Dalits then did something unprecedented. They tracked cattle carcasses to the city center and left them to rot at the steps of the government offices, pointedly refusing to remove them. Cow vigilante groups have mushroomed across India since the electoral triumph of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. They see their work as sacred, but in practice, they roll around villages and rough up livestock traders and herdsmen. They are feared, and for good reason. They have a reputation for their ability to inflict violence with impunity. Vijay Bhardwaj heads a cow vigilante group in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh.
It is the government's duty to punish people involved in cow smuggling, but the government is doing nothing, and cow smuggling is at its peak. Hindu society has for a long time tolerated this, but not anymore.
Dalits may have felt they had to accept this, but no longer. Their increased defiance and willingness to fight back could be the start of a national awakening for India's traditional underclass, says Vivek Kumar, a sociology professor at the Center for the Study of Social Systems in New Delhi.
It speaks of a new understanding and realization on their part that enough is enough and they are not going to tolerate this humiliation anymore.
The cow vigilante groups have been implicated in the murder of 7 Muslims this year, and India has a long history of bloody inter-ethnic and religious strife. So while the Indian government denies having any official ties to the vigilante groups, the party does nothing to distance itself from the vigilantes. That leaves the government's silence in the wake of each attack to speak volumes of its true sympathies. But now, increasing numbers of Dalits are demonstrating that they are more than capable to speak up for themselves. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. California voters will decide whether to legalize recreational marijuana in November, exactly 20 years after state voters approved the nation's first medical marijuana law. But the medical pot industry is divided on full legalization. Some say they're worried it will open the floodgates to agribusiness and destroy the state's cottage industry for growing marijuana. Others say legalization has the potential to benefit poor communities of color who are hardest hit by the war on drugs. FSRN's Carla Green has more from Los Angeles.
Hello. I'm meeting with a commercial medical marijuana grower in Los Angeles, or as he prefers, cultivator.
Do you mind if I close the door?
Yeah, go ahead.
Cool. Okay, so we're going to use a pseudonym for you.
Yeah.
We'll call him Aaron. We were supposed to meet at Aaron's grow-op, that is, his indoor growing operation. But just a couple hours before the interview, he called with a change of plans.
Well, I started having second thoughts. I started thinking about the security issue, and it's just bad security culture to bring people around your place if they don't necessarily have to be there.
Medical marijuana is legal under California state law, but because of a confusing web of county, city, state, and even federal laws, what that means in practice varies wildly. And that means that most cultivators, like Aaron, live and work with the prospect of being busted. The irony is that these illegal grow-ops sell to dispensaries, who in turn, legally, sell to medical marijuana patients with a doctor's prescription.
Cultivation exists in a gray area of the law. In most of California, particularly in Los Angeles, we all know dispensaries have existed for a while, and basically it's legal to purchase medicine from them, but they haven't quite addressed where that medicine actually comes from yet.
A ballot initiative this November could change all of that. California could follow Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska to legalize recreational pot. That doesn't mean everyone is on board, though. At a recent California Growers Association meeting, the membership was split down the middle. Aaron himself is ambivalent about it. He tries to explain.
I switch back and forth. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no. Coming from the activist community, it's hard for me to vote against a bill that's going to legalize adult use and decriminalize it. So I would probably hesitantly vote yes for it.
Cultivators are entrepreneurs. There's fear of the unknown. Wholesale prices could fall. Big producers could squeeze out the smaller competition. Come through this section around. Virgil Grant and Donnie Anderson run a couple of dispensaries in Los Angeles. Anderson's also the lead chair of the California NAACP's Cannabis Task Force. Some growers worry that once pot is fully legal, the big money will come in and take over production and sales. But Grant says there's another side to that coin.
If you look at the statistics with a white person going to jail for the same drug offense, they'll do less time, and the minority, black or Latino, will do more time.
Grant has firsthand experience with the war on drugs. He was released from federal prison last year after serving just under 5 years for criminal conspiracy to distribute marijuana. Local authorities are struggling to get a handle on the marijuana boom. On the one hand, recreational marijuana is still stigmatized. Not everyone thinks it should be legal. On the other hand, the expensive war on drugs is increasingly unpopular. And if the laws are changed, cash-strapped city and county governments want in on the millions in untaxed revenues, maybe as much as $1 billion, according to one state government estimate. Armando Godinho of the Pro-Legalization Drug Policy Alliance spoke at a recent Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors meeting. He was there to warn against stoking the black market with unreasonably high fees and levies.
Because the black market has historically thrived in communities of stricken with poverty and disadvantages. So I think, you know, and then that will in turn probably maintain the same style of policing practices that we've seen, you know, historically.
Legalizing recreational marijuana isn't just about the big vote in November.
So this is good old, you know, politics at play. And, you know, because it's marijuana, it's no different. In fact, it's going to be just probably even more complicated.
If the ballot measure passes, there's hope that some of the harm of the war on drugs might be reversed. But, of course, there are challenges, too. Of not pricing out the little guy, or excluding urban black and Latino communities. All of that is in play as California voters prepare for the November vote. Another step in the state's long-running debate over weed. Carla Green, FSRN, Los Angeles.
The Los Angeles Times reports Friday that more than 350 square miles of land have already burned in California this year. 8 people have died, and 300 homes have been destroyed. The ferocity of recent wildfires in the Sierra Nevada mountain range has been alarming, while drought, infestation, and the effects of climate change threaten the survival of some of the West Coast's most wild forest land. 66 million trees are already dead, and it could be 100 million by the end of the year. FSRN's Vic Bedoian takes a closer look.
Riding in his pickup truck near Shaver Lake, Jim Bluestein reflects how this mountainous landscape is changing. Bluestein manages a 134-acre tract owned by the Sierra Music and Arts Institute. He says it was once some of the healthiest ponderosa and sugar pine forest around. But now...
we are experiencing cataclysmic changes, and they are accelerating because there's so many effects and causes that we aren't even clued into, which are already in effect.
Bluestein and his crews have been working for years to remove the hazardous buildup of dead wood and undergrowth that could fuel the next wildfire. Commercial timber interests say one solution is more widespread logging. Bluestein disagrees.
Number one, we should not, in fact, be cutting any healthy, maturing timber. Number two, we should, in most of these out-of-control, overgrown forests, we should be cutting most of what is 10 inches in diameter and smaller. Most of the brush, most of the thicket.
By this method, Bluestein argues, we're left with sparser forest. That, in turn, allows more water for trees that are left to grow healthier, and also more water soaks into the ground, feeding the state's rivers, streams, and aquifers. It's not just about the trees. This mountain range is one of the primary sources of water and hydropower for California's population and farmland. And the vegetation and the soil itself capture carbon in the atmosphere to mitigate against climate change. Roger Bales is director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute based at the University of California, Merced. He says the good news is that California's water users are beginning to recognize how vital these forests are for the state's health.
The Association of California Water Agencies over 2 years ago passed a board resolution pointing out the need for watershed restoration and maintaining our headwaters as part of the water infrastructure.
Water users are at last recognizing the cyclical nature of drought. Less water, weaker trees, more insects, more dying trees, leading to less water. This summer, California Assemblyman Jim Patterson toured the Shaver Lake area to view the devastation. He promised to use the emergency situation to focus government action more quickly.
The upside of emergency is you learn what you can do when your focus is on the emergency and on fundamental priorities, yeah, and you see that it happens. Yeah. And, you know, we learned a lot, I think, over the last 40, 50 years.
Then there's climate change. Average temperatures in the high Sierras have risen by 5 degrees over the past 20 years. California Governor Jerry Brown has already allocated $30 million this year to remove dead trees threatening official infrastructure like roads, power lines, homes, and public spaces. But forestry manager Carolyn Ballard says that does nothing toward addressing the underlying problems or restoring the health of forests.
We need to move forward into looking at reforestation, and we need to look at resiliency treatments and things that we can do in terms of what kind of forest or what kind of landscape do we want to have in, say, 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years.
From behind the wheel of his Toyota pickup, Bluestein says small crews could be deployed to get work to suppress fire hazards without doing more damage to the ecosystem.
Thousands of small crews would be moved into the forest, like, right away. And they would have chainsaws, they would have chippers. That way the material that we cut and thin, we can clean it up as we go, get that carbon low, where it can help to keep moisture and nutrients and microbial action on the forest.
But with state funds for forest conservation scarce, it would likely be up to the federal government to step in. Scientists, forestry managers, and others know that these woods are trying to convince decision makers from state capitals to Capitol Hill that the need for action is now, before it's too late. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Shaver Lake, California.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Jacob Resnick provides editorial services from Bonn, Germany. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Semaphone via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.